The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Today's episode of The History of Literature is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/HOL. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's www.audibletrial.com/HOL. Okay. I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the podcast. Let's start with some Shakespeare today. We're going to listen to a snippet from a performance by the amazing Judi Dench in her 1979 portrayal of Lady Macbeth. Macbeth here is played by Sir Ian McKellen. Is this a wonderful world or what? To have these two individuals playing these two roles. This is from Act 2, Scene 2.
Answers that knocking. How is it with me when every noise appalls me? What hands are here? They pluck out mine eyes. Will all great Neptune's ocean wash this blood clean from my hand? No, this my hand will rather the multitudinous seas incarnadine, making the green. One red.
My hands are of your color, but I shame to wear a heart so white. I hear a knocking at the south entry. Retire we to our chamber. A little water clears us of this deed. How easy is it then?
To wear a heart so white. It's a wonderful line that I've overlooked before. Shakespeare's so rich, so deep. It's easy to do that. There's another line in Macbeth where it says, "It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." You might miss the resonance of that line, but then a William Faulkner arrives and calls his novel The Sound and the Fury, and suddenly you see the line in a sharper focus. To wear a heart so white. You might be guessing what I'm getting at here. Let's talk about the scene first. Macbeth has just committed a murder, and his conscience and his subconscious are giving him trouble. Lady Macbeth arrives and is appalled by his weakness. She takes the daggers from him, the murder weapons, which he has clumsily brought along with him in his self-conscious, guilt-ridden haze. She takes the daggers, returns to the room of the murder, leaves the murder weapons behind, smears blood on the servants to frame them for the murder. This scene has some of the great soliloquies in Macbeth, or indeed of all of Shakespeare. Macbeth wrestles with his thoughts. Sir Ian McKellen in this spare production is amazing. And as usual, I get so caught up in certain lines that I miss others. This is the scene where Macbeth says that if he tried to wash his hands of the blood, he couldn't do it. Wouldn't work. His hands would turn the multitudinous seas incarnadine, turn the green to red. The words stopped me on my first read as a senior in high school. What? Multitudinous seas incarnadine? What? What is that? Bafflement, not understanding what those words, what any of it meant. Then I sort through the vocabulary, the footnotes, look things up, get the meaning. I remember being floored at the feeling of guilt. Such a horrendous thought to be in this post-murder funk, overwhelmed by what he's just done, the awfulness of a murder committed with his bare hands, the physical reality of it, that blood, the blood you still see on your hands, the blood of another. And he doesn't think his hands will be clean ever. He thinks his sin could stain an ocean. It's a flight of the imagination, but it's very powerful. And then, in Lady Macbeth's next lines, this little gem. My hands are of your color, but I shame to wear a heart so white. Actually, let's just listen just to that. Just listen to Judi Dench in just this snippet.
My hands are of your color, but I shame to wear a heart so white.
A heart so white. A heart so white. It's a beautiful line that captures her and where she is, where the character is at that moment. Responds to Macbeth beautifully. Macbeth's talking about turning green seas to red with his sin. She says, the world isn't white, Macbeth. Hearts aren't white. They're red. Get over yourself. You're a king. This is about power. You've been promised this, and like thousands of leaders before you and thousands who will come after, your hands are not going to be immaculate. They will be stained with blood. Own it. Not owning it is shameful. We'll need to do an episode on Macbeth soon. I'm celebrating the days after Christmas here. Boxing Day, I guess you could say it is. I had a nice holiday. Thank you. Well, I know you didn't ask. I thought I heard you wondering if my holidays were nice. Anyway, they were nice. The family is good. We're spending some quality time together with food and family and lots of warmth and love. I gave many more presents than I received, of course. Anyone with kids knows how that goes. But I did receive a couple of books about Shakespeare that I'm excited to dig into. So we'll have some more episodes in this new year. Lots of good things on the list. And today we have a conversation with our old friend, Mike, president of the Literature Supporters Club, who's talking about one of his favorite novelists, the Spanish philosophical novelist, Javier Marías. Javier Marías, whose best novel, or at least the best novel to begin with, according to Mike, who's an expert, is called A Heart So White, which of course Marías took from the Shakespeare line, the Macbeth line that we looked at earlier. Marías is a fascinating creature. He's enormously successful. His works have been translated into 42 languages, but he's almost completely unknown in America. Wonder why that is? We'll talk about that with Mike. Here's how the New York Times book review put it. Quote, "It is a rare gift to be offered a writer who lives in our own time, but speaks with the intensity of the past, who comes with the extra richness lent by a foreign history, and nonetheless knows our own culture inside out." Yet, strangely, Javier Marías, who is famous in Spain and garlanded with prizes from the rest of Europe, remains almost unknown in America. What are we waiting for? End quote. So, what are we waiting for? For Marías to win the Nobel Prize? Let's not wait for that. Let's let Mike, who's been immersed in Marías for a while now, tell us something about Javier Marías, why he is so good, and what the rest of us are missing. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat
has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
How did your interest in Marias begin?
So, I was at a garden party, and it was kind of an old fashioned actual summer afternoon garden party with drinks and by the water and lots of.
And what were you wearing?
So I was wearing a blue gingham shirt.
Did you have a straw boater hat?
I did not, but I did notice a couple of men with. Wooden bracelets, and various accoutrements, and women wearing very nice earrings. And so I met a young couple there who were really into books. And by young, I mean younger than me. And we got into this conversation. We were all drinking. We got into this conversation. We asked each other what book we would recommend if we could just recommend one book to a person. Mm. And so I chose Contempt by Alberto Moravia.
Mm-hmm.
And they both independently chose and then agreed with each other, which was very sweet, A Heart So White by Javier Marías.
Ooh, the couple. So, they had the same book.
So, yeah, I mean, he's in his 60s now. He's written, I think, 13-odd novels. He's written 25 nonfiction books. He has his own newspaper column where he espouses on history and linguistics and sociology.
Hmm.
He came from a really cultured family. His father was a famous philosopher, and it's funny, when he was starting to write, a lot of people would say, like, oh, are you related to Julian Marías? And he'd say, yes, he's my father. And Javier Marías got tired of being asked that, so as he aged and got gray hair and turned 30 and 40, he used to tell people that Julian Marías, because some people would remember the name Julian Marías but not really remember who he was, and he would say, Julian Marías is a philosopher, and he's my son.
Oh.
I'm his father.
Right. Well, and that seems perfect for him, right? Because it seems like he has that kind of an attitude toward time shifting anyway. You know, it's almost like the past tense and the future tense and all of that gets all kind of jumbled together. And it doesn't surprise me that he would be drawn to the idea that he is now older than his father was at certain points in his father's life, and that that would in a way kind of make him like an older generation.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There are moments in his novels where he talks about how, oh, that person is dead, and now I'm going to be older than them.
Right.
Which is a funny twist that, if somebody dies at 38, they're always 38. 30 years later, they're still 38 because they died then.
It really is striking. And the other thing you see sometimes is maybe a younger brother or a younger sister who's 3 years younger than someone is forever 3 years younger than the older sibling. They could be 82 years old, but when they get together with their older sibling, they're still the little kid.
Right.
And it's a strange thing when you think back to your grandparents or your parents and you think that you're older than that person is when you remember them, even though, of course, you always think of that person as being such an older generation.
Yeah. And to a lesser degree, and I'm not sure Marías does this, but I think it's implied is that when you lose touch with a friend from a certain part of your life, say high school, and they go on living, and you go on living, but you're not in touch with them. And then suddenly you, you meet them again, it's almost like they're forever 14 or they're forever 16.
Yes.
And it's hard for you to have this older person superimposed on your such a realistic, vibrant person in your mind who is 16.
Right.
And so Moraes is very interested in the way we try to remember someone's best self.
Mm. Right.
And how it's almost better not to see them again.
And, you know, I know he's kind of, at least in the interviews and the things I've read, I don't know if this has changed for him, but at the time when I was, when he was talking, he was kind of a technophobe, and it makes me wonder how he would handle Facebook, because that's sort of the issue. When you first jump onto Facebook, you make friends with all of these people that you knew 20 years ago or so. In his case, maybe it would be people he knew 40 or even 50 years ago, but he would quickly get updated as they're posting pictures of their children and grandchildren and talking about things that are important to them now. It would really shift his conception of who those people were. I suspect he would not like it. Maybe that's exactly the kind of reason why he is not jumping in on the internet or even a cell phone, I think.
Yeah, he doesn't have a cell phone. He doesn't have a computer. He has a blog that he's now admitted he doesn't write.
Yeah, right. It's just like an assistant who will say, I will be giving a reading in Madrid next week, and it's ghost written.
I think of him a lot when I'm on Facebook, actually, because I've befriended people, and I have this Moraes-esque lines in my head. I befriended people that I got along very well with when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And we continue to get along now on Facebook, but we will never get together.
Right.
And that's such a strange kind of friendship where, you know, because sort of like, what's the point of having a friend if you never see them? And here we've made this kind of tacit bargain, that this contract that we're never going to meet. And I feel like there are a lot of those kind of relationships where people are never going to meet. It's at the same time false and at the same time so honest.
Just to make it personal for a minute here, I think you are, if you are ever in danger of losing your position as president of the Literature Supporters Club, I think we can just replay the sentence. I think about Javier Moraes a lot when I'm on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of friends who really think that there is no time to watch a Will Ferrell movie and read Joyce.
Right.
You can't do both. You have to choose. And although I think that I disagree with that, I feel like it's such a good standard to have,
mm-hmm.
you know, to aspire to. So
right. Now, does Moraes, I know you said he has a column, and I think in his column he writes about, you know, film or sports or just general politics or current events. Do you feel like he'll go highbrow and lowbrow, or is he applying a very academic and aesthetic perspective to whatever the latest news of the day is?
You know, I've never read his column because I basically stopped reading the newspaper about 10 years ago.
Right.
Because it was taking up too much of my time.
So it's Will Ferrell, literature. Those are the two, but then the third, the newspaper, doesn't make its way onto the list.
Yeah, and sometimes I'll start a New York Review of Books article, and see that there's a review of the same book in the London Review of Books, and I'll kind of like read a paragraph from each and see which is the winner. And then, because I'll think, I don't have time to read two reviews.
Right.
And some of this is a little ridiculous. It's in my head. I probably do have time to read two reviews, but it's relaxing in a way to just close that off. And I think that's why some of my friends who refuse to see pop culture movies, it must be relaxing to just make these categorical imperatives. Like, I'm gonna read all of Joyce before I watch Will Ferrell.
Right. And I, you know, I think that the other thing is, I used to worry that I would run out of things to read. Not in the sense that I thought I was going to read all the published books in the universe, but like, I can remember Maybe it came from the days when my parents would take me to the mall and my dad would let me buy one book and he would say, you know, don't finish the book. Don't read it in the car if you're going to finish the book. I want you to have something to read tonight too. Or, you know, you go to the library and you get a bag of books and then you run out. And when I was traveling, you'd find yourself with nothing to read because you read the one book you had and you hadn't had time to go to the store and you were just sitting there in your room at night with nothing to read. And it was this horrible feeling. I think people, if you have, you know, you bring along a phone or a device or something, you're not caught like that without something to read. But there was part of me, I can remember somebody said to me about the New York Review of Books a long time, you know, 20 years ago, somebody was saying, yeah, their problem is these articles are too long. Who has this much time? And I thought, that's exactly why I like it, because I won't run out, you know. And now I think it's probably, you know, that the habits are still ingrained, but I don't think it's the same. I don't have the same panicky feeling of, I'm, you know, have only 10 pages to go. I better start hoarding the pages here.
I will say, though, that I love the New York Review of Books when they take six books and they review them all at once. I think that's, by the time I finish that review, I'm ready to discuss the book and outdistance anyone in a conversation other than people who've actually read those books. So I always love that feeling.
Right.
That,
I like it too when some of the books are, you know, they were published 10 years ago or something. You know, it's not like six books that are just all about to come out. It's digging deep into some author and going through all their works. Okay, let's get back to Marias. So you had mentioned that he was a translator, and I know that was an important thing for him. And the list of people that he translated is pretty, it's pretty astounding. You mentioned Hardy, but he also translated Conrad and Faulkner. Faulkner, I think, was really important to him. And the other one I like on the list is Robert Louis Stevenson, which ties back into Graham Greene. We talked about Robert Louis Stevenson, I think, was Graham Greene's, was it a cousin, first cousin of his mother, I think. And I like that. You know, Maria seems to have some similarities with Graham Greene, where he doesn't mind putting together a good plot, even to explore some deeper themes. And the other person who he translated, who I think was really important to Maria, is Lawrence Stern. And I heard he has a bust of Lawrence Stern in his house, which must be one of the few in existence, I think. But Tristram Shandy, certainly that book reminded me a lot of the Marias that I've read, where the narrator is circling around and pausing for digressions. And I'm about to get back to my story, but first let me tell you about this. And then one anecdote leads to another, and then I'm still going to get to this next part of the story, just trust me, but before we get there we have to talk about this. And that just seems like Maria's translating that probably felt very liberated or very confirmed that it matched his own sensibility and where he wanted to go as a novelist.
That's exactly right. I mean, he said that if he ran a writing program, people would just translate writers.
Right.
That's how they would learn the mechanics and the passion behind writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what he says, you feel like it's being said for the first time. I mean, I should read his column. I was reading, so he's very witty. I mean, he was saying that his mother went to college and majored in literature at a time when most women in Spain did not go to university. He was saying, my mother read a lot to us and told us stories. I've been told by my father that my mother used to lull us to sleep by reading us the Iliad. I hope that was an exaggeration on his part, because it sounds very pedantic. you get the flavor of his sense of humor there. I mean, in just three lines. I mean, his sense of humor is outstanding.
Yeah. I wonder what drew his mother to studying literature, if it was just a love for reading, or if she was trying to improve herself, or maybe she came from her own literary background where maybe her parents had an interest.
My little pet theory is that she was writing.
Right.
And that the whole V.S. Naipaul and his father writing all his life, I think there are a lot of people who try to write, or it's not trying. They're writing, but they're not publishing. I get the feeling that people who love literature at some point must try their hand at writing.
Yeah, and John Updike's mother is another one. Updike was another person that Marius translated, which I was a little surprised by that. I guess maybe not. I guess the age Marius is, Updike would have been a popular writer. I think we've just kind of moved on so much from Updike, and I think of him as being a, what's the line of, he has nothing to say and nobody says it better. On the other hand, Updike did do a lot of reviews of European authors. I think that was a conscious decision on his part. He didn't want to review other Americans because he felt like it was a little too competitive and that it brought out the worst in him and it didn't do him any favors with the community. So he went through a stretch where for a couple of decades he really focused on European authors. So maybe that was one of the things that led Marius to come across Updike's path.
Yeah, I mean, Marius is a huge movie fan, and he's a huge fan of American culture. He actually was crazy about the TV show Bonanza. I mean, just talking about, you know, Will Ferrell and stuff. I mean, his works are so philosophical, and yet he kind of knew how to hang out and relax.
Right.
All his life, he's never been married. He's had lovers. His partners were married and lived in different cities. I think currently he's been seeing the same woman who lives in Barcelona. He lives in Madrid. I mean, there's something, it sounds like he balances his philosophy with a lot of just relaxing pleasures.
Right.
So, going back to what you were saying about running out of things to read, I love rereading. I've reread A Heart So White 5 times.
Mm.
And each time I just find myself enthralled. And, you know, for this podcast, I wanted to try to find a bit of a passage to read. So I thought I'd kick off a little bit of close textual analysis with this passage from A Heart So White.
Okay.
So the book begins with a murder. A couple of his books do begin that way. And like you were talking about plotting, he's very interested in plot twists, which is amazing to think that someone who's mainly a philosophical writer has organically worked in plot twists
right.
into his novels.
Right.
This is, the narrator is a translator and meets this woman, Louisa. A lot of his female characters are named Louisa.
Why do you think that is? Was there a Louisa in his life?
He said there isn't, but he just likes the name. And he also likes the fact that a lot of people try to see connections between the female characters.
Right.
And I think he finds that an interesting experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it's backward, but basically the narrator is a translator. The woman, Louisa, is an interpreter.
Okay.
I think the difference is an interpreter translates live.
Right.
They both work for either the UN or some kind of international organization. And whenever two politicians are speaking, you'll have an interpreter, but then you'll have a translator listening in to the interpreter. Okay, I have it backwards. The male narrator is the interpreter, and the Louisa is the translator who's vouching for his authenticity.
Okay.
And in the middle of the politician's discussion between a Spanish politician and a British woman, the narrator kind of makes a few creative translations, and Louisa lets it go. And then he sort of outright mistranslates stuff because he thinks it's going to help the discussion. And she again lets that go.
Right.
And so the two of them are kind of enjoying each other's company at this point. And then the English politician, this woman, says this. And they're talking about their countries, but they're also talking about their close relationships, because this is the first time they're meeting and they're trying to bond. So the British politician says, "So any relationship between two people always brings with it a multitude of problems and coercions, as well as insults and humiliations. Everyone obliges everyone else, not so much to do something they don't want to do, but rather to do something they're not sure they want to do, because hardly anyone ever knows what they don't want, still less what they do want. There's no way of knowing that. If no one ever obliged, anyone to do anything, the world would grind to a halt. We'd all just float around in a state of global vacillation and carry on like that indefinitely. All people really want to do is to sleep. The thought of future regrets would paralyze us. Imagining the consequence of acts we haven't even committed is always dreadful. That's why we politicians are so necessary. We're here in order to take the decisions that others would never take, immobilized as they are by their doubts and their lack of will. We listen to their fear. The sleeping and the dead are but pictures, Shakespeare said. And I sometimes think that's all people are, paintings, asleep today and dead tomorrow. That's why they vote for us and why they pay us, in order for us to wake them up, in order for us to remind them that their hour, though it will arrive, has not yet come, but that meanwhile, we'll make their decisions for them.
Mm.
I love that line. If no one ever obliged anyone to do anything, the world would just grind to a halt.
Yeah. You know, I had this conversation with this friend of mine not too long ago, and he was trying to get at my motivations for certain things. And I said, you know, basically, I'm just governed by two things, and it's fear and guilt. And and he said, well, what are you afraid of? And I said, feeling guilty in the future. And part of me was recognizing myself in, you know, the part where it was saying that, I can't remember how he phrased it, but it was basically saying that people would fear of future regrets, you know, that would incapacitate people.
Yeah.
But yeah, then, you know, as it went on, I began thinking Mussolini said things that were very similar to that politician, where he said, you know, people are tired of making decisions. They're tired of making choices. We're going to just make those choices for them. And what's wrong with that? It's what people want.
Yeah. I mean, it's so perfectly tied into the plot, this philosophy of being obliged. And so, and when you said as it goes on, I think so much of Maurice's philosophy is that it goes on, because it's not, you don't get this philosophical soundbite and then we return to the plot. The philosophy just goes on and on. And here, these politicians are trying to broker a deal to avoid a war. And you have this kind of looking down on the citizenry and saying, we're the courageous ones. And it's a long scene. It's such a great scene when the narrator starts lying.
The theme of this is set up pretty early. And I was surprised to hear you say that Marius has never been married, because there's that great passage early in the book where he talks about the difference between being part of a married couple and being single. And he talks about the two sets of footsteps. Do you remember this? And he says, you know, when you're dating, you meet at a restaurant, and then afterwards the footsteps can go in two completely different directions. And there's a choice right there. You remember that? And he says there's a choice there, and maybe they'll walk together and maybe they won't. And maybe one will go a short distance and one will go all the way across town, or kind of talks it through. And then he says, but when you're married, you go to a restaurant and there is never a decision afterwards. The two footsteps will always go in the same direction after that. It made me think that he was a very that he was writing about that from a position of someone inside a marriage. But maybe it's this thing of something that you fear is something that you know. And maybe that was the fear that he had, was that the footsteps would go in two different directions. And that's why he was able to write about it.
Yeah, I mean, I love that, where he takes something so romantic, and he doesn't quite lose the romance, but the romance is at a bare minimum, when he's just like, we always know where we're going to go. We're going to go this way. We're always with each other. We always.
Yeah.
And so I love that. I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of married couples in his novels, and there are a lot of single people actually who have been burned.
Mm.
There's a character in A Heart So White, a woman who, she may have a limp, and there are other factors, but the limp has not helped her, you know, find a husband.
Mm-hmm.
Maraeus crafts this incredible flirtation that she is undergoing with a stranger. And I don't want to give too much away, but you know, in the back of your mind, he's planted this limp.
Hmm.
And he returns to it in a way that is so surprising for someone who writes the way he writes.
So I wonder if the reason why you've read this five times, if plot has a lot to do with it, because one of the real pleasures of something that has a great plot, I mean, obviously, it's not just twists and turns, because now you know how things end and the plot is familiar, and one would think that that would make you less likely to return to a book. But when a book is really well done and the plot is has such an impact on the characters and the reader's understanding of what they're doing, and it's a real pleasure to return to something like that and to just see how it's done and to feel it all the way through over and over. It's almost like you're riding this roller coaster, and it's, you ride it the second time and it's almost more fun because you know, well, this part where I'm going up, I'm about to feel this, and then it goes on this curve and I'm about to feel that. And it doesn't make it less pleasurable because you know the order. It almost makes it more pleasurable.
Yeah. You look forward to it. You look forward to the twists that you already know about. Exactly right. I mean, he uses eavesdropping really well in his novels.
Right.
And
which is, by that you mean it's giving information to a character in order to give them a new understanding and a new shift on their way of thinking.
Yeah, and often, well, sometimes it's better to, and it's a truism, you know, it's a cliche that it's better not to know. But when you see it in a plot, it's the way he does it is very clever.
Mm-hmm.
You really want to know what happened to, you know, put your mind at ease. And when you find out, your mind is a maelstrom. It's not what you wanted.
This kind of thing, it's makes it sound like he's a master plotter who probably charts and graphs everything out in this really schematic way, but it's actually the opposite of that, isn't it? His writing process is such that he basically starts with the first sentence on page one and he writes until he's happy with that and he moves on and then he goes to page two and page three. And I've read that he never will return. Once he gets to page 200, he won't go back and rewrite page five. And he said that one of the advantages of that is that he then can surprise himself, or that the narration can still have the capacity to surprise him, which he thinks if it's surprising me while I'm writing it, it will be a surprise to the reader. Whereas if he had mapped it all out and charted it all out, it wouldn't have that ability because someone might guess where things were going to go.
The subtlety is in the surprise. He has this epic novel, Your Face Tomorrow. It's a 3-volume work. It's like 1,300 pages. And apparently his notes for that are like 4 pages long. and they're like on A5 paper, that really boxy paper. He's so involved in the way the characters are trying to make sense of their experiences that a lot of things that you encounter in novels as kind of a midway or near the end of the novel, that feeling, he will just start with it.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's like a very classic Javier Marías move.
Right.
The murder, yes, it's a plot device, but I also think it's kind of like a wake-up call to the way people think of a murder as this, oh, it was building up to it.
Mm. Right.
The Infatuations, which is a more recent novel, has a female narrator, which is unusual. Every day she goes to a cafe and watches this very handsome couple, and one day the couple doesn't show up. It turns out they stopped showing up because the husband in the couple was murdered.
Hmm.
And she befriends the wife. And they together uncover something about the husband.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I read his books, I often think like, oh, could he have done it differently? Whenever you read a well-plotted book or see a Hitchcock film, you think like, oh, could he have started with this? And
right.
Marías always starts with this dramatic. He starts with the dramatic first.
Mm.
He has this, let me see if I can find this line, of what he thinks of this is an infatuations, but I think of it as a commentary on his work, why he starts with the murder, what it means for a stranger, because readers, when you start a book, you're a stranger to the characters. So what does it mean to like come across something that dramatic? And so he says, "We live quite happily with 1,000 unresolved mysteries that occupy our minds for 10 minutes in the morning and then are forgotten without leaving so much as a tremor of grief, not a trace. We don't want to go too deeply into anything or linger too long over any event or story. We need to have our attention shifted from one thing to another, to be given a constantly renewed supply of others' people's misfortunes, as if after each one we thought, how dreadful, but what's next? What other horrors have we avoided?"
Hmm.
It's like he knows that the murder will mean so much. Let me start with it, get it out of the way, and then have that in the back of our heads.
Right. Well, I think it's also probably, it fits right in with his narrative style of digressions, because it's easy to make people wait. You know, it's easy to make the reader say, I will be waiting to hear what happens to that murder, or, you know, what you're going to tell me, the next piece you're going to tell me about what led up to the murder, because I know the stakes are high enough that I'm willing to sit through this digression about somebody's long lost relative or something, knowing that the main story is so compelling.
Yeah, no, that's true. That you know, I was chatting with a friend of mine and saying that you don't really need that much plot, but if the plot is who killed X, that's more than enough.
Right.
That frees him to digress.
You know, there's a whole genre of detective fiction where that's or mysteries where that's basically what they do, right? The first two or three pages, you'll have this body. He's a little more philosophical, but you get the feeling that he has borrowed heavily from the genre in order to figure out how to plot some of these books.
I was reading an interview, you know, I call him a romantic writer. I think he is, but I was reading an interview where he said, I've seen very generous, kind, and noble people behave very badly because they are in love. Equally, there is this idea of destiny. People remember how they met and wondered what would have happened if they hadn't gone to the bar or that dinner. But we are, in fact, very limited in our choices of partner by location, class, history, and who is willing to accept our advances. How many times are we not the first choice, or even the second or the third?
That is the thing. I mean, even though we've been talking about murders and the figuring out how someone's story led up to, you know, the body lying on the floor, he seems like he's fascinated by the stories that everybody carries around in them, or the stories either of their relationship or their childhood or whatever it is. And it's almost like the stories coming into conflict with one another, or being unraveled by a perceptive narrator figure, seems like kind of his great subject is the intertwining narratives and the ability of a person to unpack all of that in order to find some meaning in the world.
He does such a good job of retelling a story. They're anecdotes, but they're also, for like a three-page anecdote, it's an amazing story. I think of Alice Munro, you know, she'll write a 15-page story and she'll work on each story for 9 months.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And she'll say there's so much that didn't go into that story. And you really feel that. And I think you feel that in some of the Maria's anecdotes. There's a lovely anecdote in A Heart So White about how the narrator used to buy his pencils at the stationery shop, because the shop girl there, who was his age, I think he was 14 and he used to go there. There was this 14-year-old shop girl and she was really pretty. And so he used to go there all the time to buy his pencils. And then he went on to college and he went back there and she was still there. And she was still working there. And it's in that short, in that very short anecdote, it captures those kind of complex feelings of recognizing that love or liking, lust for her was kind of, you know, superficial.
Mm-hmm.
But also thinking that it meant so much to him when he was 14.
Right.
That he really looked forward to buying those pencils. And sometimes I read some of his anecdotes and think like, God, that could have been a story.
I mean, right.
Yeah, that could have really been a short story or maybe even a novel. I mean, some of his anecdotes. And, you know, that's such a great feeling when you read that. You know, he's not writing to get things out of the way. Sometimes you feel, you know, oh, okay, like this passage is fantastic, but that other passage, he was just trying to convey those facts.
Hmm.
Most of his novels are quite short, actually. You know, Your Face Tomorrow is a real exception. He really shows you that all these stories that you think have already been done, adultery or adolescent love, he shows you that there are fresh ways to write about this.
Okay, so A Heart So White is clearly the one that I should read first.
Yes.
After that, would you recommend a second one, or should I read A Heart So White a second time?
I would read All Souls because he spent some time, I think, at Oxford, and he wrote a book based on set in Oxford called All Souls, and it, being an Anglophile, it has a lot of, it's a little bit of a book of manners,
mm-hmm.
but it has the usual Javier Marais, you know, machinations in your head, and then it has the plotting, and it's a very charming book. And then I would probably go back and read A Heart So White. I would tackle Your Face Tomorrow. I like The Infatuations a lot, but I think, you know, it reminds me a little bit of A Heart So White, and I just think, oh, maybe I'll just read A Heart So White.
So, for a sixth time.
Yeah.
So thanks for giving me the recommendation, and thanks for joining me again on The History of Literature.
You're very welcome, and I invite any listeners to let me know if the third or fourth reading of A Heart So White held up.
That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to Mike Palindrome for joining me. It's always good to hear from him. We recorded that one in July, I think, or might have said some different things if we had done so more recently, or maybe not. In any case, I ran out and bought A Heart So White, and I recommend that you do the same. I also recommend that you check out audibletrial.com/HOL, our sponsor of the show, who will generously give you a free audiobook just for visiting audibletrial.com/HOL and signing up for the 30-day free trial. They have a Spanish version of A Heart So White available, and they also have other Marais works in English. It's the new year coming up around the corner. Time to subscribe to the History of Literature podcast if you haven't already. That will really help us out. Also, reviews, rankings, sharings on Facebook, sharings if that's a word, likings, sharings, tweetings. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. Anyway, subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any forthcoming episodes. Our next episode is a real treat. A special New Year's episode on great openings in literature. A repeat visit from the novelist Vu Tran, who recently attempted to teach a course based on 10 great opening chapters in literature. We'll hear how that went. And he and I will dive into the chapters themselves, in the first sentences, take them apart, and see how they work. All that's coming up. We also have Irving's List, the famous Irving's List to work from. I've been trying to work through those. I've been getting some email on Martin Amis and Christopher Hitchens, so maybe it's time we take a look at them and that group. Many more guests are on tap for the new year, including novelists and poets and lovers of literature. It's going to be a great year, everyone. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.